And welcome to Worlds Apart. Trading territory, total security, or ambitions for peace, a lasting settlement of the Ukrainian conflict would require different give and takes from each of the parties. But first, they would probably have to part with their own sense of righteousness. Does the historical moment or the nature of this conflict allow for this? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jeffrey Roberts, Emeritus Professor of History at the University College Cork. Professor Roberts, it's always a great pleasure, personal pleasure to talk to you. But on top of that, I'm heartened that some academic exchanges between Western and Russian scholars continue as this crisis continues to escalate. Where do you think we are in this debacle? What stage the conflict has taken?
I think, my current feeling is we're in a very dangerous moment, yeah? And the danger arises.
This is the same thing you said last time we talked.
Well, it's actually, I think it's got worse, yeah, more dangerous, yes, because the closer Ukraine comes to defeat, the more desperate and potentially reckless the West is getting, and the more powerful extremist voices are becoming. So it's quite possible that we may see some extreme actions to sort of bolster up Ukraine's defense. And obviously there will be a danger of escalation arising out of those actions.
What do you see as potentially extreme actions from the side of the West? Because it's clear that Ukraine is becoming more liberal in its open use of terrorist tactics, but what about the West?
Well, I mean, all the talk at the moment is the introduction of Western troops in some form. That issue seems to be on the agenda again. There's also talk about no-fly zones. Yeah, all the kind of stuff that was being discussed at the beginning of the war and which Western leaders refused to contemplate at that time, but they're back on the agenda, and they seem to be having more been taken more seriously and having more purchase. Now, I don't think the intention of those kind of actions, troops on the boots on the ground, or some kind of air power intervention, it won't be to sort of like precipitate a wider war of Russia. That won't be the intention. But of course, that will be the danger. That because obviously Russia, I don't think, will allow those actions. If there are Western troops on the ground wherever they are in Ukraine, they will be attacked by Russia. And the same goes for Western Air Force involvement.
Now, something like this was contemplated 2 years ago. But as you say, it seems to have more purchase power. Among whom? I mean, does it have more purchase power among people at large? And why would that be the case? Because, I mean, it's pretty clear that whatever Western thinkers or strategists thought of the Russian army 2 years ago, their presuppositions were defeated, to say the least.
Well, it certainly doesn't have any purchase in public opinion. In the West, yeah, all the public opinion data we have, suggests that popular opinion is moving in the direction away from war, in the direction of peace, in support of some kind of a compromise peace. And were NATO or particular Western countries to do something reckless, like introduce troops or get troops to get more involved directly in conflict, there would be an enormous kind of like outburst of popular opposition to that. So that's certainly a restraining factor. How strong these voices in favour of direct intervention are, it's difficult to say. I mean, there's certainly a lot of them at the moment. I mean, there are counter voices, but I think the thing that worries me most is that the whole pattern of this conflict, from the point of view of the West proxy war in Russia, has been a pattern of persistent escalation, one escalation after the other. So they've done it so often, it's almost become habitual. I would be shocked, but I would be surprised if they take further escalatory steps.
Do you take this escalation as a calculated tactic? In other words, when people raise up the ante, do they actually understand? Are they conscious of what they're doing, and the possible reply from the other side?
I think it's partly a calculated tactic, but I think it's also a very emotionally based tactic, because they've talked themselves into a position where they least in terms of their rhetoric, they really believe that if they lose to Ukraine, if Russia wins in the Ukraine, it's going to be the end of the Western world as we know it. You know,
it, but won't it be to
no,
some extent?
No, it won't. And it's important that we don't actually buy into that discourse. The Ukraine war would be a huge blow to NATO and to the West, to Western prestige. It would be critical. There'd be all kinds of crisis arising out. But no, I think the Western world, as we know it, NATO, the Western powers, I think will remain unless the war goes on and on. Yes, and Russia penetrates even more deeply into Ukraine. Russia comes to occupy the whole of Ukraine, and then the war continues in other form. Yeah, in that kind of extreme situation, yeah, then possibly we are looking at a much more kind of apocalyptic outcome.
Let's discuss something that you and a number of other Western scholars proposed recently, and that is a compromise to end this war. In fact, you suggested in one of your recent articles that Vladimir Putin could stop this war by negotiating a peace deal that includes Ukraine's membership of NATO. Why do you believe that this proposal, which is the underlying premise for this conflict, has any buying power, not only in Moscow, but first and foremost in Kyiv and in Washington?
If there's going to be a negotiated end to the peace settlement, then there's going to be some kind of Western security guarantee of what's left of the Ukrainian state after the war, right? That's the first point. The second point is that NATO and the West have politically and rhetorically would find it very, very difficult to back away from accepting Ukraine into NATO membership, even under conditions dictated by Russia. That's the second thing. And the third thing, strategically, having Ukraine in NATO would have advantages from the Western point of view. It would mean that Ukraine in NATO, what's left of it, Western Ukraine, presumably, would constitute some kind of buffer zone with Russia. Okay, this buffer zone would be a demilitarized zone. There'd be no NATO bases, no nuclear weapons, all kind of restrictions. But nevertheless, you'd have an independent, pro-Western NATO member of Ukraine actually the buffer zone. So there are all kinds of good reasons for the West, United States, NATO, to accept such a deal.
Now, you keep mentioning this phrase, Ukraine or what's left of it. And I think that's, the crux of the problem. And a number of Russian analysts indirectly agree with you because they claim that what is now being decided on the battlefield is where that boundary between Russian and Western security perimeter will lie, whether it's formal or informal. And clearly, Moscow is interested in pushing it further into Ukraine, but I'm not sure it wants to push it as far as, let's say, Western Ukraine with its very hostile and anti-Russian population. Now, based on history, based on the current sentiment, where do you think that boundary could lie organically for, if there is such a term as organic boundary between Russia and the West?
I think, as of now, the natural boundary would be acceptance by Ukraine and the West of Russia's incorporation of Crimea and the four additional provinces, and that in a way that's the only absolutely hard and fast Russian war aim, is that it's going Russia, those territories are part of
that's
Russia.
Already the reality on the ground.
And the constitution, So that's the minimum. How far you go beyond that? Yeah, it depends on the war. And okay, some people argue that maybe you should go as far as Kharkov and as far as Odessa. The problem with that is, yes, that may well, in a way, that may well be a natural kind of historical, cultural, political boundary, but it will be enormously costly for Russia to actually occupy Kharkov and Odessa. Okay, but bottom line is, I don't see Russia expanding any further into Ukraine than Dnieper.
Now, you also suggested that if the Kremlin were to contemplate such a concession, Ukraine and its Western backers would have to give, quote, cast iron commitments to Ukraine's permanent demilitarization, albeit within the framework of NATO membership. And first of all, I'm not sure the Russians believe in any degree of firmness of quote unquote Western commitments. But on top of that, you know, demilitarized within the NATO framework, isn't it a bit like, I don't know, a terrarium with wipers, but well-behaving mice? I mean, like, even if Ukraine is demilitarized under, like, it's not Ukraine that is a problem for Russia, it's NATO.
There is a kind of precedent for this kind of agreement, because when East Germany was united with West Germany and became a part of NATO, the agreement was...
But NATO was different at that point of view. It treated Russia or the Soviet Union with respect. It saw the danger in it.
Sure, but the agreement was that there would be no NATO expansion into East Germany. Of course, what happened later on, NATO didn't expand into East Germany, but of course it expanded into the Baltic states, Poland and other countries. So there are precedents for conditions on NATO's expansion, yeah?
Now, I think there's also a more recent precedent that could support your case, the case of Turkey. A number of Russian leaders, including Putin himself, said that having Turkey as a part of NATO is not that bad for Russia because it contains that country, which is a natural competitor, regional competitor for Russia. And I can see that logic being applied to Ukraine, but I struggle to understand why would NATO want, ravaged, highly traumatized, virulently angry country or whatever left of it as part of its military alliance.
You raise an important point there. You know, I think from a Russian point of view, it's not Ukraine's membership per se that mattered or ever mattered. It was the NATO military buildup.
Use of Ukraine as a tool for anti-Russian politics.
So if Ukraine or what's left, it becomes part of a NATO under different conditions, then it's not such a threatening development. I mean, you asked the question about, why should this issue of trust? Yeah, the trust cuts both ways. You know, there's trust issues on both sides, and the only way to work through that issue is to actually make agreements. And see what happens, and try to make those agreements stick. As the Russians like to say, trust but verify.
But I ask you about a slightly different aspect of it. Why would NATO want? I mean, I understand NATO's logic of having Ukraine as sort of semi-affiliated member of its alliance and using it as a sort of battering ram against Russia. But if they actually have to take responsibility for Ukraine's angry intentions, for rebuilding it, for even providing it with some infrastructure, why would they need it? Because they are losing all the benefits of their policy and assuming all the costs.
I think for political reasons. I mean, that's why why did I come forward with this suggestion that Ukraine could become a member of NATO under certain conditions and that could be part of the deal? I was trying to think of a way that politically, giving the West a way out politically to back off from a forever war with Russia, proxy war. That was my kind of reasoning. So I think it would be an enormous kind of challenge, an enormous problem, all kinds of disadvantages. I'm sure there will be plenty of voices here in NATO saying no, we shouldn't do this. But I think for political reasons, NATO would find it very difficult to actually turn its back on Ukraine completely and refuse to allow it into membership. Yeah.
Well, Professor Roberts, I hope you are right on that, even though, to some extent, it's, facing the consequences of your own policy, applying it to yourself.
Look, I'm not making a prediction here or a prophecy. I'm not sure what's going to happen. In fact, it's unlikely.
Well, I know what's going to happen right now because we are going to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. pictures designed to simplify or confuse? Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jeffrey Roberts, Emeritus Professor of History at University College Cork. Now, Professor Roberts, before the break, we talked about the Russian rationale, NATO's logic. Let's talk about Ukraine right now. And I think that's a very interesting case study because it's hard to find another country the size of Ukraine that would so eagerly assume the role of a client state without negotiating any developmental or security guarantees for itself. I mean, even Israel, for example, another client state, is very shrewd about, ensuring its own base. But Ukraine sort of threw itself into the Western embrace completely without, asking actually for much. How do you understand the calculus of Kyiv here?
Yeah, this is the most difficult. I think it's the most difficult for me for you to understand is why Ukraine chose the course it did and why it still chooses to fight on. Obviously it's to do with the power of Ukrainian nationalism. I mean, the emotional power. As well as the political power of Ukraine nationally. That'd be one thing. I think, secondly, there was this kind of faith, belief in the West, in Western support and in Western power, so that they persuaded themselves that they could win this war in some form. Okay, and now having tried that, actually effectively lost the war, they're just clinging on there and waiting for something to happen, something to turn up. But look, we were talking about public opinion there. Public opinion in Ukraine is shifting as well. All the opinion data I've seen is that there's a gradual shift towards a majority of Ukrainians living in the areas currently occupied by Ukraine who want a compromised peace. I think, secondly, the Ukrainian political establishment is not a monolith either. Yeah, there are kind of elements within that establishment, or maybe on the fringes of it, who would be prepared to actually negotiate peace. Who see peace as being the best solution for Ukraine. Now, I'm not going to start giving you names here because that would be invidious, to say the least. Yes,
I have a personal question. I have Ukrainian roots, and Ukraine is a very interesting collective psyche to me because I think it has both very large entitlement and a very large inferiority complex. You mentioned the power of its nationalism, and to me, it's a little bit like Medea, who is ready to kill her own children because she didn't get something. Mm. And historically, I think this fury was channeled very conveniently onto Russia. But once Ukraine becomes part of the West, aren't you concerned that this sort of the target of its blame will shift?
What you describe is actually quite a typical phenomenon of small state nationalism. Yeah, and I know that Ukraine is not a particularly small state, but it's a small state associated.
Well, it's getting smaller population-wise.
It's a small state associated with a big state, and quite often, what you describe, this sense of combination of entitlement and inferiority complex, very, very typical of the nationalisms of small states. So in a way, that's not surprising.
That's not unusual, but many other states, sort of middle states like Turkey, Israel, even Poland to a lesser extent, they've been quite skillful in playing, big powers against one another. And this is what I want to ask you about, because I think leadership or the cultivation of elites is a very interesting subject because it takes time, it takes certain national hardship to produce the kinds of elites who understand the deep dynamics, psychological and developmental dynamics of their populations, but who are also worldly enough to position their country within the regional and global context to, produce benefits for their people.
Yeah, but that's what happened for Ukraine. For the first 25 years of independent Ukraine. That's exactly the game that Ukraine played.
Really?
Yes, absolutely, until 2014, when you get this definitive kind of split, and a part of Ukraine opts definitively for the West. And that's where
the problem stems from. With all due respect, Professor Roberts, I think Ukraine had some of the best conditions post-Soviet collapse. They had some of the best economies. They had pretty wide industrial base. They have, good land. They have a lot of people. They have the good graces of the West. They also had the good graces of Russia, because Russia was eager to keep them within their, if not within their, within its orbit, then within its economic environment. And yet they seem to waste it all on something that's hard to understand.
They also had a lot of corruption, and also that they also kind of had deep divisions, ethnic political divisions, didn't they? What that meant was that Ukraine never transitioned out of the 90s. The kind of chaotic politics of the 90s continued all the way through. Yeah, and of course the other thing that Ukraine never had, they never had a Putin. To actually come and assert some stability, assert the power of state, some order and control, and some direction. So, a very unfortunate set of circumstances for Ukraine. But going back to another point, I think that once the war's over, if what's left of Ukraine becomes part of the West in some form, it's already part of the West, and that's not going to change. I think the Ukrainians are going to turn on the West at that point. They're going to have a very, very different view and feeling towards the West when they see what has happened to their country, that they have fought this proxy war on their own behalf, also on behalf of the West, and they've suffered this huge kind of trauma, this huge damage, this huge loss of life. And actually, I don't think they're going to blame Russia and the Russians for that. They're going to blame their so-called Western allies.
In order to be a self-sufficient country, they have to accept that, fool me once, blame on you. Fool me twice, blame on me. I mean, sooner or later they will have to accept their own responsibility for their own destiny, and also develop some acumen and shrewdness in dealing with their neighbors. Do you see developing?
Maybe not. I'm not sure. But look, to be a self-sufficient country with any kind of like semblance,
even
of,
within it, the Western alliance,
yeah,
I
but,
mean,
but they all,
to
they
negotiate
all,
for
to
yourself.
To be an independent country, they need to keep Odessa, or at least access to Odessa. They probably also need to, for symbolic reasons, they need to keep Kharkov as well, right?
Are you making an argument for Moscow now if you want a peaceful Ukraine on your border, keep Odessa there?
I think that, they're not there yet, but the prospect of a major military defeat or Ukrainian military collapse, which is going to threaten the Russian taking over Odessa and Kharkov, as well as all the rest of southern and eastern Ukraine, that actually might shock them into actually coming to their senses and making the deal, right? And giving up on this war, right? And making the necessary concessions to Russia.
That's actually a very, very good and I think historical argument, because historically Russians have had the foresight of how you should treat your enemies in order to create, conditions for lasting peace. It was the case both with the French and, with the Germans as well. I think that's something that...
I think that's another very important point in favour, the kind of argument that I'm putting, that Russia should make this really huge concession of allowing Ukraine or part of Ukraine to become a member of NATO under certain conditions, is because still Russia wants to have a benevolent attitude towards Ukraine and Ukrainians as a people. And if that attitude holds, if Russia wants to reconstruct its relations with the Ukrainian state and with the Ukrainian people on a collaborative friendship base, recreate some kind of semblance of friendship.
Then they need to
give something to Ukraine, at least symbolically, yes?
It's quite a different thing. I mean, you say they need to give something to Ukraine, like NATO membership, and what I'm arguing for is that they have to consciously recognize Ukrainian dignity, and that if the Ukrainian state is to exist as a state, not just as some fragment of NATO, but as a state that has some potential for self-sufficiency, then it needs certain geographical assets.
I have the impression that at least a majority of Russian public opinion and political opinion, elite opinion, would be on that page. Yeah, okay. There are a minority of, you know, Russian nationalists who would want to go further than that. But I think that's where the sentiment is. But of course, you know, sentiment's one thing. You know, strategy in politics is another, and you know, Russia, Putin, the people, Russian people, Delhi, are not going to concede anything which is going to compromise Russia's security.
But it's not good that we came to that, because it's not just about Ukraine. I mean, for Russia either. Russia cannot have Ukrainian sensibilities at the top of its head, because at the end of the day, we are all talking about pan-European security structures. Sure. And you've written about it. You said that a lasting settlement of this conflict would require creating a system that would contain rather than incubate conflicts. And I think the Russians did their best trying to negotiate some way out of the predicament with NATO. They weren't successful. Washington said no. Is there anything possibly that could persuade it change its perspective?
I think the war, Ukraine and the West defeat in the war, it might affect a change in that perspective, on the basis of, Ukraine can become part of NATO on certain conditions, but there would need to be an overarching framework of common European security to act as a container of that and as a safeguard and guarantee for both sides. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Russians, actually not the Russians, but the Soviets before them, have been trying since the 1930s to create collective European security structures, including the Soviet Union, including Russia. But they've always kind of like stumbled against the fundamental factor that in the West, Russia has been seen as a rival, an enemy, an opponent, and a threat. And it's quite tragic that it's taken, it may actually take this war, this tragic war, to actually arrive at a situation where there can be some kind of sensible negotiation about creating common security space.
Professor Robertson, this is going to be my last question. For that to happen, what the West will have to part with is the idea that, you know, it controls events in the world, economic, ideological, cultural, everything else. And there is an opinion in Russia that what Russians are fighting against here is not just the, you know, pan-European security structure. They are fighting against 500 years of Western dominance, which is first and foremost based on the Western military dominance, and which both the Soviet Union in the 20th century and I think Russia more recently has managed to not necessarily rival, but at least undermine. If the West agrees to any sort of negotiations with Russia, wouldn't that effectively mean that its view of the world is shattered? I mean, like, it will have to give it up.
There's a lot to be said for the point you just made. And it brings us back to the point, you're at the beginning of our discussion, when you asked me, how do I see the situation at the moment? I said, it's dangerous. It gets even more dangerous. And it fundamentally gets even more dangerous because in the West, or at least a substantial section of the West, is not prepared to give up on that self-image of itself, on Western hegemony.
Well, it's not just self-image. It's
It's superiority. And they've constructed what's going on in Ukraine as being, you know, an existential battle that if Ukraine loses there, if NATO loses in Ukraine, then, you know, they're going to lose their domination, their hegemony, and the West's place in the world. And that's why they're advocating the most extreme measures to avert that outcome. So that's when it comes down to it. You know, the fundamental obstacle, to ending this war doesn't lie with Russia or with Putin or what it might do. It lies with the West, and what is it actually capable of changing its fundamental worldview and accepting a different set of relationship with Ukraine, with Russia, and in Europe as a whole.
Absolutely. And I would add to that ultimately what the West is fighting against is not Russia. It's fighting history, and history has certain objective trends to it that even, you know, the West cannot negate. But let's leave it for some other time. It's been great talking to you again.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.